presenter, Kathy Lett, who's joining us again from EPA's Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. So Kathy, whenever you're ready to begin, please do.
Okay. Thank you, Jean. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today for the webinar, part two, to talk about the Generator Improvements Rule. Today's webinar is going to talk mostly about the new provisions that apply to very small quantity generators. We talked about, last week we talked about hazardous waste determinations and counting and mixing and marking and labeling. Today we're, those were kind of tweaks and changes to existing parts of the program. What we're talking about today with episodic generation and VSQG consolidation are new parts of the program that we put in the Generator Improvements Rule as a result of years of comments that we got both from implementing agencies and generators themselves. Also today, we have a little change of schedule because of some conflicts here in the office after we talk about episodic generation and VSQG consolidation. We are going to do our slides on closure, so you can expect that and look forward to it at the end. So I do want to point out that other than the changes with episodic generation and VSQG consolidation, we don't have any changes for the VSQG program other than the new term, very small quantity generator, which replaces conditionally exempt small quantity generator in the federal regs. So these are the main changes that apply to very small quantity generators with the 2016 rule. So we still have limited requirements for very small quantity generators. They're the same basic standards that you're familiar with from 261.5. As part of the reorganization of the regs, they are now located in 262.14. So that's where the requirements can be found. And both the things that we added, the episodic generation and the consolidation, they're both things that add new options for flexibility for those very small quantity generators. I'm going to be talking about episodic generation. And it does actually affect both very small and small quantity generators. The provisions are very similar, so we're going to talk about it all in Module 3 instead of splitting it up and talking about it twice. But I do just want to make sure that we note that it's for very small quantity generators and small quantity generators. But we think a lot of the use will probably be the very small quantity generators. So the reason that we made these changes to the program regarding episodic generation is really that we heard that the previous RCRA rules lacked a lot of flexibility when addressing an episodic change in the generator's regulatory category. So what we mean by that is that occasionally a generator that's operating as a VSQG or an SQG has an event that bumps it into a higher generator category. And it's just a short-term event, and it isn't a permanent change for that generator, but it's something that they would have to then go ahead and comply with the more comprehensive full set of regulations for a short period of time when they were generating those higher levels, and then go back to, they would be going back to being a VSQG or an SQG. So this provision is designed to address that situation, but as you'll see all the way throughout our conversations about this, is that the balance that we were trying to find was how to ease the compliance burden for that specific situation and do it in a reasonable way, but also do it in a safe way that, you know, maintains protection of human health and the environment. The basic challenge was designing it in such a way that you're not creating a loophole for generators, that really ought to be permanently operating in that higher category. So our solution with episodic generation was to provide a streamlined set of requirements that address this situation specifically. And those are found in a new subpart of Part 262, subpart L. And as I said, the regs in that subpart apply both to VSQGs and SQGs. But a critical part of the provision is that we're maintaining the requirement that all the waste be shipped as hazardous waste to a TSDF or a RCRA designated facility, so a TSDF or a recycler. So that means, you know, using a manifest and sending to the TSDF is really a critical part of this new provision. So we just wanted to make sure that we put in our presentation here where the episodic generation regulations can be found. And they're in two parts. One is 262.13c8, which are the counting regs that we talked about last week. And paragraph 8 there states that hazardous waste managed as part of an episodic event does not have to be counted toward the generators category. So that's the first part that tips the generator to go look at subpart L. And then subpart L, which is 262, 230 to 233, that's where the generator will find the conditions for the episodic generation provision. So the first step in looking at these regs is, of course, going to be looking at the definitions of these terms, what we're talking about. So an episodic event is an activity or activities, and they can be either planned or unplanned, that don't normally occur during generator operations and that result in the increase in the generation of hazardous waste that exceeds the calendar month quantity limits for the generator's usual category. So again, if the generator, you know, is going along as a VSQG month after month and then has an episodic event, they might bump up to SQG for a short period of time. I'll get into the specifics of that time period in a couple slides, and then bump back down to being a VSQG. Again, they can be planned or unplanned. So a planned episodic event would be maybe regular maintenance or a clean out, some sort of short-term project, or the removal of inventory. An unplanned episodic event would be something that the generator did not plan or reasonably expect to occur, and that might include something like process upsets, recalls, a spill, or some sort of storm or act of nature. This can be found in 262.231. We do want to note that hazardous waste from regular production is not an episodic event, even if production is higher than normal, which leads to more waste. So that's really more of a business decision. You know, maybe it's a factory that gets more orders than normal, so they up their production, end up with more waste. That's not an episodic event. Okay, so how often can a generator have one of these episodic events and operate within subpart L for it? So our goal in determining how many events per year was to make this provision useful and implementable, but also to maintain both adequate protection for human health and the environment and to make sure that it wasn't misused. So what we ended up with in the rule was that a facility can have one episodic event per year and then have the opportunity to petition EPA for a second event. So I do want to point out that if there are a couple of different things going on at the facility during the time limit for the episodic event, which I think is the next slide, that is permissible under subpart L. And then if they do go ahead and petition for a second event, then if their first event was planned, then if they have an unplanned event later in the year, they can petition for that. The generator can't have two planned or two unplanned events in the year. It has to be one unplanned and one planned event per year. So an example there is that if the generator conducts a cleanout in the spring and then has an unexpected recall in October, they can petition the state for that second episodic event. And or if the generator has planned a small episodic project for the fall, but something happens earlier, like a hurricane, and causes a spill in July, they can hold that episodic event in July and then petition for their planned event later in the year. We really wanted to maintain the state's ability, the implementing agency's ability to have oversight over these facilities as far as allowing for this petition process for a second event. Okay. As promised, how long can an episodic event take place? So basically what we finalized was that an episodic event can last 60 days. So that 60 days is from the first day of this episodic event. So that would be the first day of generation of waste. For an unplanned event, that would be the day of the storm or the spill. For a planned event, it would be, you know, the first day that they're generating waste as part of their event. And then they have 60 days, and at the end of that 60 days, all the hazardous waste has to be shipped off-site already. Anything from the event that is still on-site would have to be counted towards the generator's regular category for the month and be managed under the regulations for that category. We do think we got a lot of comments in this area when we did the proposal, and a good portion of those comments thought that our proposed 45 days wasn't long enough for an unplanned event in the case that waste has to be characterized and arrangements have to be made for disposal. So that's how we ended up with 60 days. We do want to note that if a generator doesn't know if the event is going to be an episodic event, so maybe particularly in the case of an unplanned event, they don't know on the first day whether or not they're going to have enough waste to bump them into the next category, for instance, or maybe they don't even know if their waste that they're looking at is hazardous because they haven't been able to make a characterization yet. So in those cases, we do talk about this in the preamble, that we think that the generator should notify with the state, and then if it turns out that the event was not an episodic event, work that out after the fact and let the state know that it was not, in fact, an episodic event. Regarding the notification, which is one of the standards that falls under subpart L for these generators, we determined that notification was really a critical part of the provision in order to avoid abuse. Just to make sure that the states have oversight ability and that a bad actor generator wouldn't be able to claim after the fact that, you know, if someone came on site that they were operating under an episodic event. So we thought that previous notification of events was really a critical part of the provision for oversight. So both VSQGs and SQGs must notify about an episodic event using the site ID form, so that's EPA form 8700-12. In the case of a planned event, the generator would have to notify 30 or more days prior to the episodic event on the site ID form. And for an unplanned event, that's obviously not practical. So the generator would have to notify within 72 hours of the event by phone or email, and then follow up with the site ID form. That 72 hours we thought was in line with spill notification requirements and left enough time for the generator to, you know, deal with things on site, possibly if it was a result of a storm and they didn't have power to deal with that, and then make their notification. We will be talking more about the site ID form next week and looking at the actual changes that were made as a result of this rule. But just so that we get through it now, what the new elements are for the notification are getting an EPID number. So an SQG will already have one, but a VSQG will get an EPID number automatically when they submit their site ID form. Then the notification also includes the start and end dates of the episodic event. That can't be more than 60 calendar days. The reason for the event, the types of hazardous waste involved, estimated quantities, of course that has to be estimated because the notification is ahead of time, and then emergency coordinator contact information. As far as actual accumulation standards beyond notification for the generators, really, they were designed to be straightforward. For VSQGs, they are required to do marking and labeling. So the label in this case has to say episodic hazardous waste. And that's because the dates on the episodic waste label work a little bit differently. And also we want to make sure that any waste that's being generated as part of the episodic event is distinct from other hazardous waste on site. In addition, as we talked about last week, for the other parts of the new generator requirements, the label has to include, or the marking has to include, an indication of the hazards of the contents and then the date that the episodic event began. So it's not the date that the accumulation in a particular drum began. It's the date that the episodic event began, because all the waste from that episodic event has to be off-site within 60 days, as you recall. For tanks, the generator can use inventory logs or other records, but they must be easily accessible. And then for VSQGs, the requirement is that they manage the hazardous waste in a manner that minimizes possibility of accident or release. The containers should be in good condition, chemically compatible with the contents, and kept closed. If a generator is operating under Part 265, Subpart I, that would satisfy this condition. Those are the federal citation for SQG, OQG container standards. So if they're operating under that, that would satisfy what they need to do here. And then if the generator is using a tank, it has to have procedures in place to prevent overflow, and there's an inspection requirement once each operating day. We do want to note that treatment is not allowed by VSQGs under episodic generation, except in an on-site elementary neutralization unit. Basically, the requirements for regular 262 that allow treatment in containers by SQGs was based on them using the Subpart I standards, and that requirement isn't in place here. So we did determine that treatment wouldn't be allowed by the SQGs in their containers. Also, hazardous waste that's being accumulated on drip pads or in containment buildings can't be managed under Subpart L. For SQGs, it's actually even more straightforward than for the VSQGs. The marking and labeling is the same. So they have episodic hazardous waste on the label, and then an indication of the hazards of the contents and the date the episodic event began. Again, for tanks, inventory logs and other records are appropriate, but they have to be easily accessible. And then the SUG would be accumulating the waste under all the conditions of 262.16. So they would have the regular container and tank standards, employee training, emergency preparedness, and prevention. Everything that they're already doing under the conditions of 262.16. And then hazardous waste on drip pads and in containment buildings, again, cannot be managed under subpart L. We do have record keeping as part of the conditions for this provision, and that's required because really operating under an episodic event does not invalidate the need for cradle-to-grave management of hazardous waste, and record keeping is an important part of that. We did try to make sure that the record keeping was straightforward. We're using the same standard that's used in a lot of RCRA, that the records must be maintained for 3 years from the completion of the event. And then, as you can see, if you look at the elements, that if the generator keeps copies of their notification form, their site ID form, and they keep a copy of their hazardous waste manifest that they use to send the waste off-site, then that will cover pretty much most of these elements. So basically, they have to have records of the beginning and end date of the episodic event, a description of the event, the types of hazardous waste generated, the quantities generated, how the waste was managed and where it went, the name of the transporter, and then if the event was a second event in one calendar year, they would have had to submit a petition, and they have to keep a copy of their approval of that petition. So we think that that record keeping requirement balances, you know, useful but not onerous as far as implementing the program. Okay, so on to the petition for a second event. So as I said before, if the generator has a second event, and one of their events was planned and the other was unplanned, this is within a calendar year, then they can petition to be allowed to have that second event. So the requirements for the petition are that it be made in writing and that it include a reason for the event, the nature of the event, an estimated amount of the hazardous waste to be managed, how it will be managed, an estimated length of the event, and then information about the previous event in the calendar year. If it's a planned event, then that petition, like a notification for the first event, has to be submitted 30 or more days prior to the second event. And that generator cannot manage hazardous waste from a planned second event under the subpart L provisions until they receive an approval. So that's important to note that if the generator submits it, they do want to probably submit as soon as they know they're going to be having the event to make sure that they hear back from the state in time to have their second event. If there's an unplanned event, the EPA or authorized state must be notified within 72 hours by phone or email, and then follow that up with a site ID form, the 8700-12, and an indication that it's a petition for a second event. So in this case, we thought that the requirement that the generator can't manage under that event didn't make as much sense as it did for a planned event, because if you run through the scenario, you realize that if they have an unplanned event and they have to start operating in the higher generation category, generator category, while they're waiting to hear back from the state, then they would, you know, be getting permission to take those controls away, but they've already put them in place. So basically what we said was that for an unplanned event, the generator can manage hazardous waste from an unplanned second event while waiting for approval of its petition. And if the petition is denied, then the generator must start managing hazardous waste under the conditions for the applicable generator category. What we don't have in the actual regulations are reasons that a state or implementing agency might deny a second event. We didn't want to tie anyone's hands with that, but we would expect that the state, when looking at petitions for a second event, maybe looking at things like the enforcement history of the facility, whether there are other problems with that particular facility, and may want the opportunity to deny that second event if it's a facility where they've had issues before. So that's not something in the regulations, but it is what some of the things that we were thinking about. Okay, so we have a couple of examples just to see how this would work. So the first one is an SQG that has a maintenance project, and they realize early in the year that they're going to have that maintenance project in the fall, and they think they're going to exceed the SQG limit. The event starts on September 17th. And it's scheduled to be completed by November 5th. That is less than 60 days, so they can use the episodic event provisions. In preparation, that SQG would identify waste codes for the waste to be generated and estimate waste amounts. Then the SQG would notify the state before August 18th, that's 30 days before the event begins, and they would use the site ID form, and then set up any contracts or plans for waste transport or management. They have to have everything off-site by the 16th of November. And then as they complete their event, the SQG would do their maintenance project, they would manage the hazardous waste under the 262.16 standards, and send everything off-site with a manifest for hazardous waste management. If the event runs past November 16th, then, you know, the SQG would have to begin operating in the appropriate generator category. I say on the slide here as an LCG, but they have to, you know, look at the waste on site and how much has been generated and operate in that category. After their event, the SQG maintains the records for 3 years, and if they have another episodic event in 2019, if it's unplanned, they can petition for a second event. A second example is one of an unplanned event. So let's say in March, a VSQG experiences a storm that causes a spill, and they think that this cleanup will cause them to exceed their 100-kilogram limit for March and April. The first day of the event would be March 8th. So that's the day of the storm. And 60 days are over by May 7th, and they think that everything will be cleaned up by then. So that can be an episodic event. For the event, they would have to notify the state within 72 hours and then follow up with the site ID form. If they already had a planned event, the VSQG would have to submit a petition, and they would operate under the episodic standards while waiting. Then the VSQG samples the hazardous waste and sets up their transportation and disposal. If they find at this point that the material is not a hazardous waste or it doesn't exceed their threshold, they can work with the state to cancel that event. The VSQG does their cleanup, sends hazardous waste off-site with a manifest for hazardous waste treatment. If they run past that May 7th deadline, again, they would have to begin operating in the higher generator category. Then after the event, the VSQG maintains records for 3 years, and if they have another event that year, then they petition the state. So that is the provisions for episodic generation. And we will, of course, be taking questions on that at the end of the session. But for now, Mary Beth is going to talk about VSQG waste consolidation.
Okay, thank you, Kathy. So VSQG waste consolidation is the other brand new provision with the 2016 rule. And the issue we're trying to address here was, you know, often there's companies with lots of different facilities, some of which are small, and they wanted to be able to consolidate their hazardous waste and before sending it off for disposal. However, under the old regs, if you were an LQG, you needed to have a RCRA permit to accept VSQG waste. That was one of the categories VSQGs were not allowed to send to was LQGs, so they had to have a permit. So what we did with this provision was we are allowing this to happen. It is limited, which I'll explain in a minute, but the idea is now, you know, larger companies that have multiple locations can consolidate to get more efficient shipping, reduce their liability because they're ensuring proper management of hazardous waste. And on our end, we feel like it's the more environmentally sound option because the waste then has to go to a RCRA designated facility. So we think it's kind of a win-win for both sides, but it is a less stringent provision than the old regulation, so states do have to adopt it to before you can use it in your state. So how does it work? Well, it's, as I said, it's limited to VSQGs and LQGs that are under the control of the same person. Person is defined in RCRA in 26010. It's a kind of a general term. Any individual, agency, corporation, partnership, etc. And then control means the power to direct the policies at that facility. So if the VSQGs and the LQG are all under the control of the same person, so basically the same company, they could take part in this program. But again, the states have to have adopted this provision. But if you're in a state where it's now in the regulations, the VSQG really just has to do a couple things. They have to mark and label their waste containers with the words hazardous waste and the hazards, like we discussed last week. But that's about it. Then they have to get it to the LQG. But they don't have to use a hazardous waste manifest, and they don't have to use a hazardous waste transporter. And then once it gets to the LQG, they're the ones that will do most of the provisions. They, one, have to notify the state using the same form that Kathy described for episodic generation, so the site ID form, that they are going to participate in this activity, and then they're going to fill out the new addendum for consolidation, and all they're going to do there is list the VSQGs that are participating. And next week, we're going to go through the site ID form in more detail and show you what it actually looks like, but just be aware that this is the form that you're doing for both of these new provisions. If you're going to take part in either of them, you're going to use the site ID form. Then the next thing the LQG has to do is keep records of each shipment from the VSQG, and these can be normal business records, you know, bills of lading, normal shipping records. When the waste gets to the LQG, they're going to add the accumulation start date to the VSQG label. Then basically the LQG just has to manage that VSQG waste as its own waste. They have to, you know, get it off-site in 90 days. They have to make sure it gets to a final its final destination has to be a RCRA TSDF or a recycler, and it's going to manage it as it manages its regular generated waste in, you know, tanks and containers that are labeled, etc. The only other thing the LQG has to do is when they do fill out the BR, the biannual report, they're going to include the VSQG consolidated waste, but we did design a different source code, G51, so that you will be able to differentiate how much that LQG consolidated from its VSQGs versus how much it generated on its own. So that's basically all the LQG has to do to participate in this program. We were asked, and we did consider extending this to SQGs, but we decided at this time to limit it to the LQGs because of there were more complicated implementation issues with SQGs. But what we did say, because we heard in comments that there were some large facilities and companies that had done so much waste minimization that they didn't have any LQGs anymore. But they, at least, you know, a couple commenters indicated they would be willing to basically change one of their SQGs into an LQG to participate. And we said they can do that. But they do then, basically the SQG becomes an LQG. They have to meet all of the same standards, and including getting the waste off-site in 90 days, and doing the biannual report. They have to have a contingency plan, and anything, any other requirements that apply to LQG that don't apply to SQG, they would have to meet. Okay, so we've been getting, since I said this was new, we have been getting some frequently asked questions, and we've been kind of compiling them so that we can try to make this as easy for everyone to understand as possible. So I'm just going to run through those. The first one is, when does the 90-day clock start for the VSQG consolidated waste? And as I mentioned, when it gets to the LQG, that's when they add the accumulation start date, so that's when the clock would start. Is there any accumulation limit for how much waste can be consolidated at an LQG? There's no overall accumulation limit, but we think the 90-day requirement to get it off-site will kind of help keep the volume down. And then, does the LQG add the VSQG waste to its annual generation amount? And they do have to report both of those if it's a reporting year for the biannual report, but there is a different source code. So they will be able to distinguish their own generated waste versus the consolidated waste. Some more questions. When transporting the waste from the VSQG to the LQG, what requirements must be met? Again, there are no specific RCRA requirements for the transport, but any applicable DOT requirements would continue to apply. Or if the state had any specific state requirements, they would apply. But they don't have to use a manifest under the federal regulations, and they don't have to use a hazardous waste transporter. Is there a quantity limit for shipments from the VSQG? Again, there's no limit on how much they can ship, but the VSQG does have to stay within its overall accumulation limit to maintain its status as a VSQG, so that should limit the quantity. Can the VSQG and LQG be in different states? Yes, as long as both states have adopted the consolidation provision. And you know, of course, they have to be under the control of the same person. And then if the hazardous waste is transported through other states on its way to the destination facility, the generator should check with those transit states to see if they can pass through. What marking and labeling should be on the containers? At the VSQG, they do have to label, which is different than a general VSQG. So they do have to put on the words hazardous waste and the hazards. And then at the LQG, they would just add the accumulation start date. And can the LQG consolidate VSQG within the same container with their own LQG hazardous waste? And what we've said is yes, as long as the waste is compatible. But we do note that the LQG would then have to use whichever had the earlier accumulation date to determine how long it could stay on site. So if the VSQG waste, you know, came in on and they added it to their own waste that had been there for 30 days, then they only have 60 days to get it off-site. And similar to Kathy, I put together an example to show you how we thought this would work. This example would be the Army. So the Army Reserve facilities are often VSQGs, and they can consolidate their hazardous waste at the Army base that is an LQG, assuming, you know, they're both in states that have adopted the consolidation provision. The Army Reserve could transport the waste themselves and would not need to manifest it as long as the LQG has notified, including listing those specific Army Reserve facilities on the site ID form as participating VSQGs. And the Army Reserve sites would need to mark the containers with the words hazardous waste and the hazards. If, for example, they were generating ignitable spent solvents, they could use this DOT placard that shows the solvents are flammable liquids. That would be appropriate with the words hazardous waste. And then once it arrives at the LQG, which in this case we're saying is the Army base, they would add the accumulation start date and then start managing that waste as LQG waste, including having to get it off-site in 90 days. They'd keep the shipping records of the waste they received from the VSQGs for 3 years. And the records would include the name, address, and contact information for the VSQG, and then also a description of the waste received, including the quantity and the date that it was received. Then the last thing the LQG would have to do was, when it's a biannual reporting year, they would report that VSQG waste consolidated at their site using the new source code on the GM form of the biannual report. So that is an example of how the new provisions will work or are working. We do know some states have picked it up, so we can, next week we'll show you a little bit and talk a little bit more about state adoption, but there are some facilities starting to use this. One last thing I should mention is we did say we would consider expanding this program in the future. So we're going to, using the notifications, we should be able to kind of track how many people are doing this and what kind of waste and what kind of volumes we're talking about. So we will consider possibly expanding this in the future. All right, now I'm going to turn it over to Brian to talk about closure.
Thanks, Mary Beth. And this is actually the last section for today's presentation, so hang in there. Before I get into it, I want to just emphasize that the closure standards only apply to LQGs, so there are no closure standards for SQGs or VSQGs, and I just wanted to point that out because this section usually comes in the LQG part of the LQG standards part of the presentation, so we're doing it a little bit out of order today. To give you an overview of the changes that we made, we consolidated all of the closure standards into one place. The old regs were kind of all over the place and had a bunch of different references to Part 265, and it got kind of difficult to figure out which regs were applicable to any given situation. We also now require LQGs to notify whenever they're closing a facility or accumulation unit. There previously were no closure notification requirements. We also added containers to the list of accumulation units that have to close as a landfill if they can't clean close. So, in other words, we clarified that all accumulation units have to meet the clean closure performance standards. And we also clarified that the closure requirements don't apply to SAAs, which I don't believe was a change, but we just put that in writing. So we're going to talk about some of the rationale for making the changes. I already kind of mentioned it, but we thought that the previous regs were confusing, and sometimes they were even contradictory, and we doubt that we were the only ones who thought that. In the same vein, we also wanted to consolidate and streamline the regs to improve the user friendliness. And we also wanted to close two important regulatory gaps. The first one was a gap in notification. Before the rule, there was no way for EPA or the states to know when an LQG had closed its facility or waste accumulation unit, which made it hard to know when and where to inspect after closure. And the second gap had to do with clean closure for containers. LQGs that were accumulating hazardous waste in tanks, containment buildings, and drip pads, they already had to close as a landfill if they couldn't meet the clean closure performance standards. The problem was that LQGs that were accumulating hazardous waste in containers didn't have any such standards, so it was more or less a loophole. And it actually caused some pretty big problems because we found that there were numerous damage cases where LQGs had been accumulating hazardous waste in containers, and they ended up abandoning their facility, and they left EPA in the states to clean up those sites as Superfund removal actions. All right, moving on to the new closure notification standards. There are two different scenarios that would require a generator to submit a closure notification. One is when they're closing the whole waste management facility, and the other is when they're closing just an accumulation unit. So when an LQG is closing a whole hazardous waste management facility, they need to notify EPA or the state twice, and that can be done via the site ID form. The first notification has to come at least 30 days prior to closing the facility, and then the second notification needs to happen no later than 90 days after that closure date to certify that they've met the clean closure performance standards. If after the closure date the generator realizes that they need an extension on the 90 days, they can submit an extension request along with the rationale for requesting the extension, and that has to be submitted within 75 days of the closure date. And I'll note that the closure date can also be changed via the site ID form as long as that happens before the closure actually occurs. So let me just go back and do a timeline just to make sure that this is clear. So say you want to close your facility on March 1st, or if you're an LQG, you want to close your facility on March 1st. 30 days at least before that date, they would need to submit the first notification via the site ID form. Then March 1st hits, and they would have 90 days after that date to complete the clean closure performance standards and notify EPA that they've been met. So that's for facility closure. If an LQG wants to close just a waste accumulation unit, they have two options. First option is to place a notice in the operating record within 30 days after closing that accumulation unit, and then they can just address clean closure when the facility closes as a whole. And the second option is to notify EPA or the state that they've met the clean closure performance standards for that accumulation unit, and that would have to be done 90 days after closure of that unit via the site ID form. So similar standards to the facility closure standards minus the 30-day beforehand notice. One of the benefits of the first option is that the accumulation unit can pretty easily be put back into service. All the generator would have to do is just remove the notice from the operating record. And we expect that most generators will end up using the first option because clean closure doesn't have to be addressed immediately, and the unit can easily be put back into service. All right, moving on to the closure standards for LQGs. The new regulations consolidated the performance standards that are found in 265.111 and 265.114 into the new LQG section at 262.17A8. So that's one of our streamlining measures. And they also clarify that all waste accumulation units, including containers, are subject to the clean closure standards. So if a generator wants to avoid having to close as a landfill, they have to, an LQG that accumulates waste in containers, tanks, and containment buildings has to do three things. They have to minimize and control post-closure release of hazardous waste and constituents into the environment. So in other words, they have to prevent and or clean up any releases that occur after closure. Second, they need to remove and decontaminate all contaminated structures, equipment, and soils. And they also have to manage any hazardous waste that's generated in the process of performing the closure standards according to Subtitle C. So basically, if they generate any hazardous waste in performing the closure in the process of performing the closure requirements, then they still have to manage that material as hazardous. And if they're not able to clean close, then they have to close as a landfill and meet the requirements of subparts G and H of 40 CFR 265. For LQG drip pad operators, they would be subject to numbers 1 and 3 above, and then also subpart W of 265 instead of subparts G and H. And I also just wanted to reiterate that these closure standards, they don't apply to SAAs. So one of the common questions that we get is how to determine if a generator has to close as an LQG. So that's situations where, you know, generator has changed generator status or generator category over time. And we would argue that there are some very obvious situations where the generator would have to meet the LQG closure standards. So, for example, if they were an LQG the entire time that they were in operation and then dropped down to an SQG for the last couple months before they closed the facility, we would argue that they would have to meet the – they would have closure obligations that they would have to meet. For the kind of in-between situations where, you know, a generator has gone up and down in generator category over time, we're going to leave that up to the state to determine it on a case-by-case basis. And the next couple slides just compare the old regs to the new. You've probably seen these before, but the red is the new text, and the stuff on the left that's in black has been modified. And I'm not going to go through this, but I just wanted to point out letter C on the bottom right is a pretty good example of our effort to improve the user friendliness. It has 9 different sections that it cites that generators have to comply with for the closure performance standards, and it even left the door open that there might even be additional sections that they would have to comply with. So hopefully folks find what we did in the new regs to be a little bit more user-friendly. And with that, I think we will now move into questions.
Yeah.
All right.
So we have a number of questions coming in. Thanks, everybody, for sending them in. And we can go ahead and go back to the beginning and start with episodic generation. So there's a few questions for Kathy. Kathy is still with us. First one is, do the generators notify the EPA or the state in regard to having an episodic event?
Okay, so basically, the notification is done on that site ID form, and that will, for a state that's adopted the rule, the notification will go to the state. So the generator notifies the state. There are, you know, a couple of states that don't have authorized RCRA programs, Iowa and Alaska. In those cases, the notification will go to the EPA region that's implementing the RCRA program.
Great, thanks. Second question is, why can't hazardous waste be managed in containment buildings under subpart L?
Well, basically when we were developing the rule, it seems like for episodic generation, we really were dealing with the smaller generators. It's our understanding that there aren't that many generators operating containment buildings out there for their waste, and they would be generating higher amounts of waste. And also, there's a number of other requirements for accumulating waste in containment buildings, and it just didn't seem like it was a good match for the episodic generation program. I don't think that there's, you know, VSQGs. I mean, I'm willing to be proven wrong, but I don't think there are VSQGs and SQGs operating containment buildings for their, you know, smaller amounts of waste that they're generating, and it seemed like it was, for the provisions for accumulating and managing hazardous waste under episodic generation, really we were looking at containers and on the outside, maybe some tanks.
Okay, great. Thanks for the clarification. The next question is there a form or template for a petition for a second episodic event on the EPA website? Since it says a petition may be made in writing, is an email okay, or is a formal letter required?
Yeah, I think email or letter would both count as in writing these days. We don't have a template among our resources for that. As far as I can remember, I don't think we developed one of those. That is a good suggestion, though. So if people think that is useful, that's something we can develop. It's a lot of the same information from the site ID form, but it would be in a slightly different form.
Okay, great. Next question. Does episodic waste generation apply to removal actions at cleanup sites? If not, why not?
So I'm not sure if this question is talking about CERCLA, Superfund removal sites. I am not an expert in how those sites operate as generators and if they would be small enough. It might be something that we have to work through. I don't know. I don't want to put you on the spot, Mary Beth, but do you know more about that?
Yeah, I don't know how it would interact with specifically Superfund removals. However, if it's just if it's a regular hazardous waste generator that has a cleanup, I think they could possibly use episodic if they, you know, meet the conditions. But
yeah, if it's just a, you know, a regular generator doing cleanup, I think that's straightforward. That if they're, you know, usually a VSQG or an SQG, and the cleanup is gonna, the whole project is gonna take less than 60 days, then it would be eligible.
Great, thanks. All right, the next question is, if you had an episodic event that started in December and went into January, what calendar year would that be in?
I would say whatever year most of the event is in. If it's exactly 30 and 30, then I guess 30 days and 30 days, I guess it would just be maybe the year that it starts. I'm not sure that that's something that we have addressed. But okay. I think that's a reasonable way to approach it.
Okay, thanks. Next episodic generation question, because there's a few. What's the purpose of estimating episodic waste quantities in the notification? It seems like there might be kind of a large kind of guesstimation in that, and it could be different from actual quantities.
Yeah, I mean, it's all kind of part of the planning process for the generator and the oversight ability for the state. You know, the idea is that these are behind having a notification that has to be done 30 days ahead of time and making sure that the state gets that information, is that these are, you know, purposeful decisions by generators that, you know, are going into this, you know, basically knowing what they're facing. And it's also to allow the state to prioritize and rank where it might want to go out and do some oversight. So if it's, you know, if they're looking at a facility that's expecting that it's going to generate, you know, large amounts of waste, then that might be a facility that the state wants to go and take a visit during the episodic event to make sure that everything is going as planned. If it's a smaller event and they're just, you know, bumping right above the VSQG threshold for a couple of weeks, maybe that doesn't rise as high in the oversight need for the state. So the idea is just to make sure that everyone is aware, both the generator and the state, of what the scope is of these episodic events.
Great, thanks. All right, this one's a little more involved, so let me know if you need me to repeat it. If a very small quantity generator provides notification of either a planned or unplanned episodic event, but the state refuses to issue an EPIAD number, in parentheses, because the state requires a $100 filing fee, does the VSQG then not obtain exemption from LQG requirements? 40 CFR 262.232A3 appears to suggest this in the case.
Yeah, I think this might be something that the state, with the $100 filing fee, has to work out. We don't have fees in our regulations. Those are state-specific. So our regulations don't address this kind of case specifically. Where I guess in this question, the VSQG refuses to pay the fee, and so they're not going to get their number. But the VSQG does need to have an EPIAD number to move forward with the episodic generation, because they're going to be, the information from the form is going into RCRA info, and they have to send the waste with a manifest to a TSDF. But the specifics about the fee are not something that I can speak to.
Great, thanks. Another one for you. Does the LDR attach to episodic waste? Does the land disposal restrictions attach to episodic waste?
That is a good question. This is something that I know we've talked about as far as this specific question for VSQGs, and I can't pull it right now. I might have to go and see what we said. I don't want to say something wrong. So I might have to get back to the questioner on this one.
Okay. Sounds good. Last one, I think, then we'll switch it up to Mary Beth. If a facility submits a planned episodic event and proceeds to generate waste associated with the event prior to the start date approved by the state, is that waste considered to count against their generator status?
One more time, Christine.
If a facility submits a planned episodic event and proceeds to generate waste associated with the event prior to the start date approved by the state, is that waste considered to count against their generator status?
Yeah, I think that's right. So if they have a start date that they've notified of and they're generating out, you know, they're generating outside that period, then it's not going to be considered part of the episodic event. I would think that if the facility is changing the start date, they should contact their state and work it out with them to have the date change. Because if the state comes on site and they do some inspection and it's not happening within the date that's been notified with the set ID form, then that's not going to be considered episodic waste.
Great, thanks. All right, moving on to very small quantity generator consolidation. The first question is, can you confirm the LQG must notify 30 days before receiving consolidation waste from a new VSQG?
Yes, that is correct. We did say that if, you know, if they notify and they put, like, say they have five, and then VSQGs that they put down as participating, and then they add any, they have to re-notify. So they have to notify at least 30 days prior to receiving the first shipment from a VSQG, and then they re-notify if they're adding VSQGs to that within 30 days.
Okay, great. Is there a mileage limitation between the SQGs and LQGs to be able to consolidate?
No, we didn't limit it that way. As long as the VSQG and LQG are under the same control, so same owner or same federal agency, et cetera, they can participate and there's no mileage, but they do. If it's in another state, both states have to have adopted the consolidation provision.
Okay. Yeah, you mentioned that earlier, and that was actually the next question, is do the VSQG and LQG have to be within the same state?
Right. So the answer is no, as long as both states have adopted. And again, this is a less stringent provision than the original program, so it is something that states have to adopt since the rule came into effect.
Okay, great. Another question. You indicated that EPA is considering expanding the rule. Do you mean that EPA might allow SQGs to consolidate waste?
Yes. I think we took comment on that option, and we also took comment on possibly doing not requiring it to be under the control of the same person, so intra-company or inter-company instead of intra-company. So I think we would, right now we're not doing it right now, and it's going to be a little while because we have to see how this plays out, but I think we would consider either or option of expanding it if we think it's successful. And a large part of that will be the feedback we hear from the states. So if states like the program and think it's working well and has, you know, enough protections built in, then we would consider that.
Okay, great. We got in a few questions for Brian on standards for closure. So I guess the first one was, we might have mentioned it in the first training, but could you define SAAs?
Satellite Accumulation Area.
Get that
so that's like as opposed to the areas where they, the central accumulation area, where they, you know, keep their waste for 190 days if they're LQGs or 180 days if they're SQGs. So the satellite accumulation areas are those small areas that are under the control of the generator where the waste is accumulated in a small amount.
Great. Thanks. Does an LQG closing their area have to demonstrate with a report that they've met the standards?
So there's no requirement in our regs that an LQG would have to demonstrate that they've met the clean closure performance standards. But they certify that they have met the standards, so I'd imagine it's up to the state or whoever would be in implementing the rule or those regulations to verify.
Okay. Great. The next one, I'm not sure if you can answer it, but we could always circle back with the requester. The question is, does EPA encourage inspection of a facility to confirm clean closure standards were met for the closure of RCRA units?
I'm not really familiar with, you know, how we do or don't encourage states to implement the rules. I don't really have an answer for that one.
I think that the other couple questions we had were related to LDR, which we talked about. This one's a different LDR one, sorry. Does LDR attach to VSQG consolidated waste, which is different from the episodic waste question we got, but in the same vein.
Right. Yeah, VFQGs do not have to comply with LDRs under the federal program. So I would say no, but let me double check that. And we have the contact information, so if I find out, I'm pretty sure that's how it works, that the VFQGs wouldn't have to comply with LDRs. I guess if the VFQG sends it to the LQG and the LQG consolidates it, actually physically consolidates it with its own waste, then the whole mixture would have to comply, the LQG would have to comply. But that's as much as I can tell you right now. I will double check, though, and let people know if that's incorrect, but I think that's how it works.
Okay, right. That's all of the questions that I see.
I saw
did
this
I miss
one.
Anyone?
Well, I saw this one. It said, can we get the old and new table comparisons? So I think you're talking about the regulations that, so you should be able to download the slides from today on the CLUIN website. And we did have some from last week. We will be posting the entire presentation at the end. So if you, for some reason, missed last week's, you know, go back in after we do next week's, and you'll be able to download the whole presentation.
Okay, I think that's a timely question. It's going to bring us to our final reminders before we go ahead and close things out today. So as we just hinted at, you can download copies of the presentation material from the seminar homepage. So I'll just remind everybody, if you look on the middle right of your screen under related URLs, you should see a series of hyperlinks. You can click on them to select one and then press the Browse to button to open it up. So you'll find the seminar materials that were used today under Seminar Resources. And then once the entire series is done, we'll have the complete deck available to download as a single file as well. I've also included URLs in the Q&A window in the lower right corner, so you can click on the links to those spaces as well. If you have a specific question, you can certainly reach out to the presenters. You'll find their contact information on the seminar homepage. And I will ask each and every one of you to take a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form. One of the most common questions I get is if we offer CEUs or PDHs for our sessions. While we do not offer those types of credit hours, many of our participants are able to document their attendance with their own accrediting institution and earn credit for taking these types of sessions. So if you need a certificate confirming your participation today, please fill out the online feedback form. Again, you'll find that under related URLs. Click Seminar Feedback and press the Browse To button. A short form will open up. I do read each and every one of those submissions, and I can assure you that helps to improve and continue future deliveries like this. As long as you fill out that form and check the box at the bottom to confirm you were here for the whole session, as soon as you submit that feedback, you'll immediately have access to the certificate. We'll print it, or pardon me, we'll email it to you, and you'll also have a copy on the screen that you can either save or print for your own records. If you joined as a group in a large room, each person can fill out that feedback form link on their own, regardless of who actually registered. So each person can get their own certificate, even if you joined under someone else's registration. And as noted, this was the second of three parts for this webinar, so we'll carry on with the third and final session next Tuesday. If you haven't registered for that one, I encourage you to follow the links to do so. We're going to go ahead and release the archive from today's session in just a few days, so you'll be able to replay this one before we kick off part three if there's anything that you missed. I want to thank the nearly 250 individuals who joined us from all over the U.S. for today's live broadcast. Thank you to all the states who gathered together as a training party in a conference room. We really appreciate everybody working together to participate in these sessions. And I also want to thank the organizers who took time out of their busy day to put on today's session. We hope this was a valuable expenditure of your time and that we'll see you with us next week when we carry on with the third part in our series. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live.